So I've got two things I want to talk about today. One's a question that's come up, and then it's sort of possibly links to sort of the area of heart wish, which is what I wanted to talk about today. You hear me right? So we had a question, I'll just read it out. I wonder where spare capacity fits as a necessary condition for the arising of metta. I'm thinking of spare emotional and physical capacity, i.e. not being in hellish torment emotionally and or physically. Maslow's hierarchy of needs comes to mind. Maslow's hierarchy of needs comes to mind. That may or may not mean anything to you, but it basically suggests that human beings, we have a hierarchy of needs. You know, basic things like food, warmth, shelter come at the bottom, emotional sort of sustenance, and then, you know, maybe spiritual things at the top. So we are greatly fortunate to have this spare capacity at present. How would I be if I had intense toothache, migraine, or end of stage, out of control, pain from cancer, I wonder? And that was sort of coming up a little bit yesterday, I think, wasn't it? So a simple answer would be yes. Yes. That spare capacity is a necessary condition for metta, yeah? We could just leave it there. pain, as Dajoti was pointing out yesterday, you know, pain closes and contracts. That tends to be what we do with pain. Yeah, it tends to move us in that direction, or that's a sort of instinctive, quite a sort of primal response to pain. And the isolation that comes from that and the additional tension is an added layer of suffering. Yeah, but it can be very hard, as you will all know, to go the other way. In a way, if there's a little bit of challenge for us in some way, then maybe we can bring that sense of metta practice and an opening sensitivity, and we might be able to work very creatively. But probably all of us have a point of overwhelm, or, you know, a sort of breaking point, which just is as it is. It is as it is, and we don't know what that is until we hit it. And in some ways, you know, it's interesting to speculate about, isn't it? I do wonder what my breaking points are, and I have a feeling that it wouldn't take that much, you know. years of practice, but it wouldn't take that much. You know, we're sort of, but it's speculation. Actually, you have no idea what is going to happen to you in the next moment, let alone in the next year. And you don't know who that person will be either. Mm. You don't know who that person will be. Mm. What you do know is that at the moment you're cultivating qualities which will allow you to be creative. I mean, I can't imagine anything that I'm doing in terms of cultivating metta is going to in any way cause me problems. I might not be able to implement, you know, to actually act it out, but it's certainly not going to cause me problems. So, in a way, there's this sort of anxiety, isn't there? It's like, what if my practice isn't strong enough? What if I can't cope? Well, in a way, we don't know. We don't know. I mean, certainly, I suppose I personally have a sort of strong feeling sometimes I sort of wonder whether we treat our practice as a some sort of like a lucky talisman or something that's going to save us from things like Alzheimer's or whatever, or, you know, will give us that ideal death that you know, everyone fantasizes about, to the extent they fantasize about dying, that is. But you know, but well, maybe not. Maybe not. I don't know. I won't know till I get there. So in a way, I don't, just for myself, I don't base my practice. That's not what motivates me. I don't base my practice on hoping that it'll sort out something in the future that is going to arise in dependence on conditions that I have no control over. All I can do is look at what conditions I have now. Well, what do I have now? What resources do I have now? What conditions do I have now? And what can I do with those? And so far, I have always found that metta, turning towards opening, that sensitivity that we're talking about, is just very, very, very helpful. It's very helpful. So, so Buddhism isn't going to save us, in a sense of make everything fine and all right. We're all going to die. That's not what's on offer. It's offering us tools to work creatively, and we use those tools to the extent that we've developed them, to the extent that we can. And in a way, there's no shame on us at reaching our limits. You know, in a way, we are conditioned. So whatever it is I am, it's not like I've done things wrong in my life. If I then come up against conditions where I can't perhaps cope very well, I have done what I've done with my life. I'm just a whole bundle. I'm not even an I. There's just a bundle of conditions that, in a way, has been to the extent I think of myself as an I. I've been trying to work. Creatively with. I've been doing what I can. I suppose that's it. We do what we can. And then you just have to sort of trust that you will do what you can with whatever arises. And that's really it as far as I'm concerned. I don't know if that... Does that sort of answer your question, Jeanette?
I had in mind, as I wrote it, that I was thinking in terms of being able to give metta outwards.
Mm.
And then I went on to reflect some more, and then I thought, oh, obviously, in those circumstances, the metta has to come inwards.
Mm. Mm.
And as you say, you do the best you can.
Yeah.
So it was more of that.
Yeah. So I think that point where we berate ourselves for not doing something well enough, you know, in a way, that... that also is moving against metta. So that's something that we can watch out for, yeah. It's like, oh, I should be able to do more, I should be able to give more, I should, you know.
Buddhism.
Yes, we've got a mug saying that in Thai, in our community.
No Shuddhism in Buddhism.
But in a way, this sort of links, this area links with the area of motivation. And it links with heart wish, which is what I want to go on and talk about a bit. So, here we are, cultivating metta. So, this mixture of opening, listening to the heart, turning towards... exploring this sort of the radiance or warmth, those qualities that are, can be there in our hearts, and also this whole area of sensitivity. So there's a sort of conversation going on with sensitivity and openness and with the heart. But it makes a difference why we do it. It makes a difference why we're engaging in all of this. So our motivation is it's an intrinsic part of the practice itself. And it affects how the practice unfolds, it affects what the practice yields. So in the Mahayana, it's very traditional to have an aspirational prayer, sometimes called Pranidhana, or heart wish.
Can you say that word again, sorry?
Pranidhana. spell that? I'm just thinking, well, I hope I've spelt it right. P-R-A-N-I-D-A-N-A.
Jones,
it's not Pranya, no, it's Pranidhana, but it might have an H in it somewhere. D-H, so D-H-A-N-A.
D-H-A-N-A.
Oh, yeah. P-R-A-N-I-D-H-A-N-A. So, but I'll call it heart wish because that's a bit easier. So this embodies our intention, and you know, many Buddhist traditions, it's seen as a preliminary. It's a sort of preliminary to all practice, is to connect with the intention. We establish the intention, and everything follows from that. So there are traditional formulations. I was just thinking of what you get with maybe the start of doing Tonglen or cultivating bodhicitta. It might be that the precious bodhicitta awakens within my heart and wisdom and compassion arise. So that's one example from the Tibetan tradition of a sort of heart wish. But that may or may not work for you. So what's important is to find out what does work for you. In other words, what actually your heart is responding to, is motivated by, what's authentic. So we've all got one, because otherwise we wouldn't be here, because it's a lot of effort to get on retreat, and it's a lot of effort to practice, and it's a lot of effort to train for ordination or be in the order. So you've all got bundles of motivation. So the question is, how does it speak? How does it articulate itself? And I think it's, you know, we can tend to sort of try and fall back on these traditional formulations. So anyway, I'll just give an example of a dream I had once where there was these monsters after me, monsters or zombies or something, and they were coming close to me. And in the dream, I knew that the only thing that was going to stop them getting me, and heaven knows what they were going to do when they got me, the only thing that was going to stop them was if I said what I truly and deeply believed. And so I tried, I go for refuge to the three jewels, and they kept coming. And I sort of thought, that didn't work. And, you know, in a way, because that's not my words. That's not my word. So it was just, one of them was just about to get me, and I went, and I said it, but the thing is, I woke up and I never could remember what it was I said. But, you know, it was like I said what I needed to say. I said truly what I was doing, not somebody else's words. I said what I was really doing with my life. Most important thing to me. It doesn't actually matter that I can't remember. I know that, you know, it's there somewhere. So this is, this is an important area for us. And it's linked, it is connected with the imagination, because in a way it raises this question for us of how do I imagine what I am and what the world is and what practice is. Yeah, how do I imagine what it is that I'm doing with my life? And sometimes, I mean, personally, I like the word imagination, but I know some people, for them it means, you know, making it up, fantasy, fiction, stories, things that aren't real, things that aren't true.
What word?
Imagination. So I was just reading a little bit of what's his name?
Sorry,
Anyway, the guy who's he spent 20 years writing about Henri Corbin, who was a sort of Sufi mystic, and his name's just gone. Anyway, I was reading a bit of him this morning, and he was looking at this area as well. He was saying literal truth is always false. I thought that's very interesting. Mm. Literal truth is always false.
Yes.
Poets and artists know this, as do most, as do the most creative of those in more seemingly literal pursuits. So he talked about a poet who uses the word fictive certainties. And then James Hillman, who's a depth psychologist, talking about healing fictions. And he was saying it's hard to entirely dispel the common sense idea that fiction is the opposite of truth. In reality, fiction is the only possible means of expressing the truth. So I thought that was quite interesting, that just saying that. So this area of what we might call fiction, imagination, story, myth, actually are ways of expressing the truth. They're ways of expressing the truth. So the question is, how do you imagine yourself and the world? And what does it do to you to imagine yourself and the world in the way that you do? And however we imagine or understand self, ourselves, our world, what we're doing, it's going to be quite unique to us. It's going to be quite unique to us. But it's not therefore a private matter. And I don't mean that in the sense of, and therefore we should tell other people. I mean that in the sense of that we are not separate, isolated entities, rattling about in the world. We are part of it, and our imagination and our heart wish, you could see that as a calling to the world. There's a calling to the world, and it elicits the response. So traditionally, going back to say Mahayana Buddhism, when you have this pranidhamma's heart wish, you might articulate that, but there's a response from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Yeah, blessings come back. So this heart wish, yeah, so it's not private in that sense. There's this responsiveness that it can set up, which is a rather lovely thought, actually. So there's a sort of mutual responsiveness, a mutual blessing. I mean, in a way, we were sort of doing that, weren't we, out in the landscape yesterday, beings, asking for blessings and giving blessings. And in a way, just thinking about the story of the Buddha's awakening, and he looks out on the world and he sees living beings, doesn't he, as lotuses coming up out of the mud. And he sees that some beings will understand if he teaches. So you've got an imagining there, you've got a way, he had an imaginative sense of the beings and the world. And he was seeing beings in the world with love. Yeah, that was basically the way he was looking at the world, was with love. And so that caused him to teach. So everything he taught, all of the concepts and the formulations and the practices, all just came out of a response of love, yeah, and an imagining of the world. So there's something about his heart wish there as well. And that was quite a heart wish, because here we are, you know, 2,500 or more years later. That's quite a heart wish, isn't it? Yeah. Still part of this lineage of metta. Okay, so I think that's all I'm going to say about that. So what we'll do, we'll have more, have some meditation and some walking meditation for the rest of the morning. This evening we will be doing something around the heart wish. So in a way, today's a sort of day for you to connect. We'll see what happens. In a way, you know, not in a sense of panicking and, oh, I haven't got one. You can just trust you've got one. Your heart's got one. Maybe you just have to wait and listen and see what it is. Allow something to emerge. And then tonight we can bring those heart wishes in some way onto the shrine. Mm.